So I'm going to be very brief and just say that today we'll be hearing about two ongoing NIJ-funded studies on custody evaluation. Both studies will be concluding within the year, and the final reports will be available and accessible through the National Criminal Justice Reference Service. So our panelists today are Dr. Daniel Saunders, a professor at the University of Michigan School of Social Work, Dr. Chris O'Sullivan, who's a research consultant currently working with the New York Legal Assistance Group, and the Honorable Dale Kosh, a senior judge with the state of Oregon. And we hope that today is the start of many discussions on this topic. And at this time, I just want to ask everyone to please turn off their cell phones or any electronic devices to vibrate or silent. And we're going to begin with Dan.
Good morning, everyone. Hope you're doing well. It's good to be here with you. Thank you, Bethany. Thank you for putting this panel together and for your introduction. And I want to commend NIJ for making this move into a new area, the family law side of the law. In the early days, the focus in helping survivors of domestic violence was to make sure that offenders were arrested just like any other offender, and that there were restraining order laws, and that we had good stalking legislation. And it's been only fairly recently that advocates and researchers have become aware of the horrible injustice when survivors finally escape from domestic violence and then are faced with continued stalking, harassment, abuse, and then, lo and behold, the worst trauma that survivors, I think, can ever go through is to get that piece of paper in the mail that says, your partner, your ex-partner, wants custody of your children. And so the trauma is multiplied times three, where women, it's usually women, are faced with sometimes losing custody to a person they believe will continue their abuse, abuse of the children, abuse of them. And so my interest was piqued many years ago doing divorce counseling, working with men who batter, and then more recently with the supervised visitation program evaluation that I helped conduct of Safe Havens. And there we saw, on average across agencies, about 20%, 10 to 20% of the non-custodial parents were women ordered now to come and visit their children. So the awareness, I think, within Office on Violence Against Women and NIJ has really been heightened. So I really appreciate the focus that's now being given. Okay, so I'm going to present some pilot data of a survey of custody evaluators, and then a little bit I'll give a preview of some of the interviews that we've done with survivors. First, I have to find the right button. Oh, okay. So my collaborators at the University of Michigan are Rich Tolman, Karen Stoller, Kathleen Faller, and then a whole team of research associates and assistants, and then consultants from law, from child custody evaluators, social scientists, about two pages worth of names that I could put up there for you. You probably know this already, that when women, and I'm talking primarily about women, men are battered as well, and you know I have a whole presentation on gender equality and inequality regarding who are perpetrators and who are victims. I'm going to speak mostly about women as survivors, that when people leave an abusive relationship, that's not the end of the abuse. And in fact, there's a tremendous amount of stalking that goes on. The risk of homicide increases, which is one reason why many women realistically stay in these relationships. They've been threatened with their lives. And then we have many other consequences as well. These men are likely, half of them are likely to find a new partner to abuse, therefore exposing the children again to more violence in that relationship. They're likely to undermine the parenting of the non-abusive parent, and on and on. I'm sure many of you are aware of these consequences. For a long time, custody evaluators and judges talked about high-conflict relationships and didn't realize that hidden within these high-conflict relationships, there is a great deal of domestic violence. And now we know from some very good, well-documented studies that 25 to 75% of contested custody cases involve domestic violence. And yet we still hear evaluators and judges talk about high conflict and don't put the emphasis where I think it needs to be, which is on the violence that occurs. Within visitation and exchange cases, based on some national surveys, the primary reason that families are referred for visitation and exchange is domestic violence, followed very closely by child abuse. There are a number of negative consequences. I mentioned losing custody to an abuser is an obvious one. We have other negative consequences as well. Having unsafe supervision, supervision by a friend or a relative, when what's really needed is supervision in a safe environment, a supervised visitation program with close supervision by a paraprofessional or a professional with separate entrances, separate parking lots, you know, all the safety mechanisms. And then we also see where too often I think there are referrals for couples counseling, for mediation, which can undermine victims' rights or place them in more danger. In terms of what we know about negative outcomes and the risk factors, it's a very sad situation that too often the abuse is never even detected by evaluators, by mediators, and then even if it is detected, it is not considered seriously in the determinations. So it may sit there in the record but not be used adequately. We know that if judges are well trained, there's a tendency for them to give sole custody to abused mothers. We have a bind in about half the states now. We have what's called a friendly parent statute, which means that, you know, one of the factors for determining custody is that the parent must show that they're willing to facilitate a good relationship with the other parent. But that puts victims in a real bind because they, for good reason, are reluctant to co-parent, to go into mediation, and as a result, they're labeled as uncooperative, unfriendly, and that goes against them. And that's a powerful effect, even in cases where there's a presumption that custody should not go to the abuser. So we're starting to uncover some of these risk factors for the negative outcomes. Okay, what is this big figure here? This is our conceptual framework that we started with on this project and lays out the major research questions and hypotheses. So starting in the middle with my red laser pointer that I don't have, but it's the one that's, it's easy to see because it's that big bold one kind of in the middle off to the right. So the main variable that we're interested in, to what extent do evaluators believe that survivors are making up stories, that they're making false allegations of domestic violence? And then if you go just up from there, we're trying to see, is that related to other beliefs, that child abuse allegations are made up, that parents are alienating the children from the other parent, and other kinds of beliefs? And then, backing up, we're interested to look at the background, the training of evaluators. Does that feed into the belief that survivors are making up stories about abuse? Gender, whether they themselves know survivors of domestic violence. I'm over in the background traits, the lower left here. And then certainly we want to look at myths about domestic violence, whether those myths are held by evaluators, and if those are related to a belief that stories are being made up. And then what we call these core beliefs, these distal factors, which are more abstract beliefs, beliefs that social hierarchies are a good thing, social hierarchies between groups, the social dominance orientation, that patriarchal norms will be related to myths about domestic violence, the belief in the just world, which is when someone thinks basically the world is a just place. People get what they deserve and deserve what they get, and we don't have to worry about oppression and differences in power. So we have some of those abstract beliefs put in there, which can still be used in training to help people become aware of their values, their core beliefs, and allow them to think and perhaps shift some of their more surface beliefs as a result. So all of this is designed to try to figure out what can we do better for training evaluators in particular, but also other professionals. Okay, so those are the background kinds of variables that we're looking at: beliefs, training, gender, and then, of course, the outcome, these negative outcomes that I mentioned already, that joint custody would be given, or sole custody to an abuser, that mediation would be pushed, that there's unsupervised or poor supervision, unsafe supervision. Okay, so this kind of lays out the hypotheses then. You can see there's many variables, many different possible relationships, and I put for you in the handouts these hypotheses in sentences. If you prefer not looking at maps, but, I mean, people have a preference, right? When you're getting directions, do you want to look at a map, or do you want to get the directions written out for you? So here are the directions written out for you, the hypotheses. And, you know, there's gender differences there, right? So who is it that likes maps and who likes the written directions? You know, I think. You can, in the discussion section, if you want to know the answer, I'll tell you then. Okay, so I've laid out the hypotheses here, and I won't take more time. I want to jump into methods. What we've done so far is to complete two pilot surveys with a total of 62 evaluators. We used web-based and mail-based administration, and we were able then to hone down and refine our measures to improve on them, because we also asked them at the end, you know, what did you think of this survey? Was it any good? What are your reactions? How could it be improved? What questions couldn't you understand? But we learned a lot. You know, evaluators don't like responding to a little case vignette that we had. They said, it would be unethical for me to put down a recommendation because I would have to do the entire evaluation. You know, I cannot respond to your vignette. So we changed that. We said, what hypotheses would you have, not what recommendations would you make? So we learned a lot through these pilots, and we're about to launch the major survey. We have measures of history of practice, experience with domestic violence cases, training, the scope of training, but also the modality. Do you go to workshops or do you read articles? So, and then we have this vignette, which is at the end of your handouts. It was modified from a journal article by Claire Dalton, and then we created various responses for them. You know, what's the likelihood that you think the mother or the father are minimizing the abuse or exaggerating the abuse? What's the likelihood of future harm by either the mother or the father? And then we have measures of these distal factors. We borrowed and stole items on beliefs about custody, visitation, and domestic violence from other sources, and then we created many of our own. And through this pilot, we found some very reliable subscales around these different themes. So the belief that there are false allegations of domestic violence that are extensive, that domestic violence has a severe impact on the children, that was another subscale, the friendly parent standard that I mentioned, and then a number of myths that, for example, domestic violence ends at the point of separation, that abusers don't undermine the other parent's ability to parent, those kinds of things. So, I mean, the questionnaire, the first one we did was very long, I think 13 pages, 125 questions, and now we're down to 80 questions. It's much shorter. It takes about 20-25 minutes to complete, and we're trying to hone it down even further. So we're going to have a wealth of information here when we're all done with this. So from the pilot survey, or two surveys combined together, 62 people. Most of them were in private practice. Some work directly with courts. And we need to balance our sample more and go out to court settings where there's a lot of good training in many of those settings where family court personnel are doing a lot of the evaluations. This tended to be a group that had lots of experience, about half of them, 20 years or more. It was 60% men, an older sample. Many of them were PhDs in psychology. and 20% had master's degrees. We also asked about their own personal acquaintances regarding who they knew as a survivor. And so we asked about friends, coworkers, and here you see that about 20% of them said that their mother was a victim and survivor. And we're going to use that to figure out, does that make them more sensitive or less sensitive in responding? Because previous research shows it can go either way. You know, with child welfare workers and other workers, it can go both ways. 40% had a friend who was a victim. Okay, here are some results then. A major question was, in your opinion, what percentage of mothers in child custody disputes make false allegations? And then we asked the same thing about fathers. And this is in general then. This wasn't first asking of those who make allegations of domestic violence, what percentage are false. So we're going to refine that a bit because this is capturing the whole group. Overall, what percentage of mothers do you think make false allegations of domestic violence? So the top one here is the mothers. And this is simply the distribution. So to interpret this, you see on the right-hand side, there were a couple people who thought that 50% and 60% of the mothers were making false allegations of domestic violence. Quite a large grouping around the belief that 10% of them were making false allegations, 5%, and so forth. So that's just a distribution across how many people, the number of respondents who believed that 0%, 10%, 30%, 50%, 60%, et cetera, were making false allegations. Okay? And then on the bottom, the question is, how many of you believe that, you know, what is your belief about the percentage of fathers who are making false allegations? And there you don't see it skewed as far on the right, and it's clumping more around the 0 and 5% area. So it looks like in terms of gender of the parent, we're seeing some effects here. And like I said, we have to refine this further, so we're tightening all this down to domestic violence cases. But we may have what people have said all along in critiquing some of the theories about parent alienation, for example, that it's, in the past it's been gendered, that it's been more blaming the mothers and having less credibility in their stories. Okay, so that might be coming through here. Very interesting. Okay, then we did find, as we thought, that a belief that there's false allegations about domestic violence also relates to belief that the stories about child abuse, sexual, physical abuse are being made up, and fathers and mothers alike. When it came to child sexual abuse beliefs, those were tied together very closely. If an evaluator believed that mom was making up stories about child sexual abuse, they also tended to believe that a father would do the same. Okay, and then what are the other relationships here, these beliefs about false allegations? Well, we found, I'm not putting any of the statistics in here, this is all just straight out statements for you. These were bivariate correlations, so these were significant R values coming through. Some were quite high, but they were all significant. So the belief in false allegations related to the belief in friendly parent standard that the mother in the vignette would be likely to harm the son psychologically, that she was exaggerating the violence, that the father was not likely to harm the son psychologically. And when it came to outcomes, their tendencies in response to this vignette, what's the likelihood that you would recommend various actions? The belief in false allegations of DV was related positively to their tendency to recommend joint legal and physical custody, sole physical custody to dad, mediation, couples counseling, no supervision of visits with the child, so unsupervised visits. So some of the concerns that we've had in starting the study are coming through. And then there was a negative relationship between false allegations, the belief in false allegations, and the tendency to recommend sole physical custody to the mom and supervised visit. So, as you'd expect, just the flip of the others. One of the questions we asked, how do you ask about domestic violence? Do you directly inquire about domestic violence? Most of them did. And then we said, what measures do you use to screen for domestic violence? And then what percentage of the time do you screen? And what this graph shows is that almost 40% of them said they never do any formal screening. They don't have any measure, any protocol that they use. And then a whole other group on the other end use such an instrument all of the time. So we've got quite a split here, and we'll do a lot of other analysis to look at the differences here and how these line up. So in the follow-up question, one person said, I use a clinicalized version of the conflict tactic scale, measured about 1 month apart. Some used the domestic violence inventory, the SARA, the spouse assault risk assessment. Quite a few of them used traditional psychological measures, the MMPI, the Rorschach. And one person said, I find I never have to directly inquire about these problems. If they are present, the abused party always mentions them. And that is why I think we need to be quite concerned. I mean, we found in many different settings, if you look at hospital settings, mental health settings, there's a tremendous under-detection of violence. And I think evaluators, with their good intentions to come in with a neutral view, don't want to rock the boat, or they don't want to raise issues that aren't there. I'm not sure what's happening here. And there are some models of conducting evaluations that say, let's base it on the allegations that come to us. Let's not base it on what we try to uncover. We're only going to deal with what comes to us from the parties involved. So I hope that as we work on this research, that we're able to have some impact on that. Regarding background factors, the sample sizes aren't real large to detect differences here. We did find some gender differences, that men are slightly more likely than women to believe that mothers make false allegations, that they're going to harm the son in the vignette. Oh, is this for me? Oh, okay. Okay, we're going to wait for the larger sample to analyze knowing a victim personally as it relates to all these beliefs. And then very importantly, of course, is how they acquire knowledge. Have they gone to workshops in the past? Have they read articles? Have they learned about post-separation violence, about the impact of violence on the children? We have all of those items in there that we'll be analyzing. In relation to core beliefs, as we hypothesized, two out of these three core beliefs were related to belief in false allegations, patriarchal norms, belief in just world. And then patriarchal beliefs also were directly related to some of the outcome measures, referring the mother but not the father for parent education, for example. Psychological evaluation for the mom is needed. And then we've conducted 11 out of 24 interviews with survivors in four communities, four different states. So we're going to have state laws also that differ. California is one where they have a lot of training provided for judges, evaluators, standards that they have. And so we're interviewing women who have lost custody or children ordered to unsafe supervision. We're also going to analyze documents that these women have from their evaluations, the judge's orders, the court custody evaluation, other orders. One woman had nine different documents, three different evaluators, a domestic violence assessment, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of work we're going to need to do there. In terms of themes coming through, I'm not going to take time to read from this one, but the focus that this survivor said needed to be on the emotional, on the psychological pain, as well as the physical. It's not enough just to focus on the scratches and the obvious injuries, but also on the emotional pain that occurs. And then we've heard this before. This survivor points this out, but we've heard it also that evaluators often focus on what happened during the relationship and forget to ask about what's going on now during the separation period. And this person brings it through that Domestic violence, whether it's past or present, needs to be considered. We're going to, in these four communities, we're going to conduct a community analysis, interviewing key players, finding out from them a snapshot of what seems to work well, what doesn't work well in their communities. So then, in wrapping up, we certainly have limitations to these pilots. It's based on self-report, and we are going to supplement that with document reviews. We'll have a total sample of 445, and we're going to expand beyond private practitioners. We have a lot of web searches that we've done, and we're also going to approach family court to be able to also survey people that work in family court settings. I think that's very important. And we've got a number of communities that we'll be going to for that. So to summarize the survey results, it was surprising in this very small pilot how many of the hypotheses were affirmed, that false allegations of DV were related to the friendly parent standard, that's related to the belief that mothers are likely to harm the son psychologically, the tendency for joint custody, sole physical custody, relationship with these distal factors, these very abstract ones, patriarchal beliefs, belief in a just world. So overall, background and core beliefs seem to be related to the belief about false allegations, which in turn are related to a tendency to order joint custody or father's sole custody. So we have a number of hypotheses that are affirmed, and with the larger sample, we'll be able to do a lot more in terms of which set of predictors overall are going to be the most powerful. We can weigh them with each other. We can put them together additively to figure out, you know, is it patriarchal norms and gender together that is going to be the most powerful predictor? So we can look at all of these effects, direct effects, indirect effects, et cetera, and have a lot more to tell. So stay tuned. Bethany says maybe next year we can do a poster, but certainly email me. I have my email address if you want more information, and then stay tuned for the final report, which will be up on the Criminal Justice Reference Service website when we're all done. So thank you very much for your attention, and we don't have time for questions now. We're going to take questions at the end. Okay, thank you very much.